Coast. This is Colin Cowherd. Join me in the herd right here on the all-new ESPN Radio 1280 AM. The Central Coast Sports
Leader. Can
we
come in at home, Dan?
18 seconds to go. The handoff to Iverson. Left-hand dribble. They let him go. Down the left side. He misses the layup. Celtics have the rebound. Rachel French. They give the foul in the backcourt. And the Boston Celtics somehow, some way, have come down to Philadelphia and have put their foot back on the throat of the Philadelphia 76ers in the Atlantic Division.
7 nights a week, 15 weeks
a year,
13 years, and counting. Sports
take
news,
your time.
Highlights, live updates.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting, City of Arroyo Grande, for Tuesday, April the 12th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Dickens.
Here.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Here.
Councilmember Arnold.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello.
Here.
And Mayor Ferrara.
Here as well. Item 3 is our flag salute, and this evening we have Troop 489 here to lead us in the flag salute, and then if you will remain standing, Pastor George Lepper is here from Peace Lutheran Church in Arroyo Grande to give our invocation this evening. Okay?
Will you please stand for the presentation of the colors? Color guard, attention. Color guard, advance. Color guard about face. Scout salute. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Two. Color guard dismissed. Scout at ease.
Let us pray. Father in heaven, we ask you to bless our council and its meeting this evening. Bring peace to our hearts and to our world. Also, Lord, comfort those who grieve this time. Watch over and protect our firefighters, our police department, and our city workers. Be with those who serve in the armed forces, and help us, Lord, to work together to make this a better city, a better place to live, in the place that you have given us in this beautiful Central Coast. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor. And you beat me to it. That's great. Just wanted to make a comment. I think you have a future drill instructor there in our midst. So very nice job.
We as a community need to teach our children how to face the future, because they are the face of the future.
Okay, my name is Matthew Richman. I'm a Live Scout in Troop 489 here in AG. Scouting's meant a lot to me. I've been involved including Cub Scouts, for a total of 8 years. There are 6 important values in scouting. Building character, faith traditions, mentoring, serving others, healthy living, and lifelong learning. Everything in scouting, from learning to tie knots to the patrol method, can be viewed in the context of at least one of these items. Essentially, these themes provide a way of looking beyond seemingly simple activities. The key is to view an activity in terms of its outcome. The outdoor component of scouting is a strong and valuable part of our program and our heritage. But the outcomes of the scouting program are what make a true difference in the lives of young people. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much to all of you. We really appreciate you being here and leading us through the flag salute. We'll see you next time. And Pastor, thanks once again for the invocation. Very good as always. That'll take us to item 5, special presentations, and we have one this evening, and I would invite Ms. Paula Tripp to join me at the podium. Paula, it's my pleasure this evening to present you with an honorary proclamation recognizing April 2005 as the Month of the Child. And if you'll indulge me, I'm going to read part of this for you. Okay. Whereas Saturday, April 9th, 2005, will commemorate the 27th annual Day of the Child celebration during Children's Day in San Luis Obispo Mission Plaza, a day where children and families interact with the agencies and programs providing services throughout the county. And whereas the Week of the Child is a time to recognize that children's opportunities are our responsibilities and to recommit ourselves to ensuring that each and every child experiences the type of early environment at home, at child care, at school, and in the community that will promote their early learning. And whereas quality child care is no longer a fringe benefit but a necessity for working parents to be productive and happy employees, local employers need to be champions in supporting the many challenges that face these working parents and families. And whereas the City of Arroyo Grande recognizes that every moment in a child's life is an opportunity for that child to learn, and that the early years may determine whether a child succeeds in school and in life, and that all children need at least one caring and loving adult in their lives, and that quality out-of-school programs are also essential for the older child. And whereas the San Luis Obispo Child Care Planning Council and the San Luis Obispo County Child Abuse Prevention Council work cooperatively to coordinate the events and activities of Children's Day in the plaza for the Day and Month of the Child, and whereas all citizens are encouraged to develop the assets in children and to do what they can at work, at home, and within the community to help young people make positive choices to avoid high-risk behaviors. Let us remember to listen and to watch the children around us, to have patience and to allow them the opportunity to enjoy the journey of childhood. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Tony Ferrara, Mayor of the City of Arroyo Grande, on behalf of the City Council, do hereby proclaim April 2005 as the Month of the Child, which represents children's opportunities, our responsibilities, and April 9th, 2005, as the Day of the Child. It's my pleasure to present this to you, and I would invite you to say a few words, if you like.
Thank you. On behalf of the San Luis Obispo Child Care Planning Council, I brought some posters and some pins and some pens for each of the City Council members, so I'll just pass this around. I'm also the director of the EOC Head Start, Early Head Start program, and we have a center in the Oceano Five Cities area that serves a lot of the children from Arroyo Grande, and I appreciate getting this proclamation because the children are a really important part of everyone's life, and I'm really grateful that you appreciate that. So thank you very much for this, and we're going to display it in our center.
Great. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, while we're passing out the posters, that will take us to item 6, agenda review. Move that all resolutions and ordinances presented tonight be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved. Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. That takes us to item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for any member of the audience to come forth and make any observations or recommendations, if you will, on items that are not
the Architecture Review Committee for the City of Arroyo Grande. I'm speaking here tonight to register my disappointment and concern over the facade changes that have taken place to the brick wall, walkways, steps, and handrail of the 100-year-old church on Branch Street in the village. This new stucco material that they have used is completely inappropriate for this type of building and looks entirely too modern. The various materials, brick, concrete, and metal that have been used over time and have now been covered up and turned into an eyesore, draws attention actually away from the church itself. On the newly appointed Architecture Review Committee, we are very fortunate to have two extremely experienced professional architects, as well as three highly dedicated individuals, one of whom has been on the committee for 14 or 15 years. I urge you to have all work stopped and have the people that are directing the work being done submit a proposal to the Architecture Review Committee to see what can be done to correct this eyesore. This property is also seeking a conditional use permit from the Planning Commission on April 19th. I did take my questions to the Community Development Department several times last week, but did not feel that my concerns were addressed. I am still unsure why this large design change did not come before the Architecture Review Committee for approval. If they had, we could have made some suggestions for alternate material that was more age appropriate for this type of structure, and even asked why the change was being requested in the first place. It is disappointing that parts of this beautiful and historic church have now been coated with a material that looks exactly like rough stucco and been painted with a faux treatment that is very unattractive. Those of us on the Architecture Review Committee are charged with preserving the character of the village or enhancing it. What has been done at the church property does neither. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve, can we follow up on that soonest? Thanks. Anyone else who would like to come forward?
Good evening. I'm Mike McConville at 529 East Branch Street, and I'd like to commend you gentlemen and the city on the traffic street bridge. Fantastic. The lights and everything else there are really great. I think it looks great. Good job.
Thank you. I'll give you a few more minutes if you want to keep talking. Anyone else? Okay, seeing no other members of the audience, we will close the community comments and suggestions. That will take us to item 8, which is consent agenda. This is a group of items on the agenda that the council normally approves in one action. We've had an opportunity to review these, and we will move forward with one motion to approve all of the consent items unless there is an item that any member of the council would like to withdraw for further discussion or independent action. What is the will of the council?
Mr. Mayor, on item B, it was the minutes from the last meeting, and it shows me as being here in the main section, and then the remaining, it shows us that I wasn't here, so I just need that one correction made, so I don't know if we need to pull it or not for that.
I think we pretty much have that. Okay. Just so you were here in spirit, so we confused us all. Okay. Any other members of the council wish to pull a consent item? Okay, if not, then I will accept a motion for approval of consent items 8A through 8F.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and we have a second. And I believe we have a resolution in there, do we not?
I've always actually wanted to say this, but we have to modify our agenda description. Only ordinances need to be read in title only. Resolutions slip right through the cracks, so we really don't need to read them.
All right.
We will make that correction ultimately.
Okay, good. Those are the two buzzwords that I focus on these items, so maybe we can take care of that. Okay, we have a motion. We have a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes, thank you. I'll take us to item 9, public hearings. We have two this evening. The first is consideration of a resolution increasing operating fees based on changes in the Consumer Price Index. And Angela, good evening.
Good evening. This will be pretty brief. On April 11, 2000, the City Council was presented with a completed operating fee study and a recommendation to set operating fees, where appropriate, at 100% of cost. The enabling resolution was adopted at that meeting, and fees were adjusted on July 1st.
We will close the public hearing portion of 9A, bring it back, and Councilmember Dickens, why don't you start us off?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This is a routine item that comes before us so that we can update our fees that we charge to recover our costs as appropriate, and I think this is just a detail that needs to be taken care of on an annual basis. And in regards to the new fee that's being added for labels, I think that's appropriate now that we have the ability to actually do those mailing labels instead of going out to a third party. So I see no problems with approving this item as presented by staff. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
I don't have anything to add to that. I also don't have any trouble with approving it as proposed.
Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Yes, I also think the fees are reasonable and appropriate, and I like that we're adding the option for the labels, so I can approve this. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
And I have to echo what my colleagues have said, that the intent is to recover fully the cost to the city. This is the mechanism by which we do it. I think it's appropriate. I have no problem, and I can support this.
Thanks. You're getting off entirely too easy tonight, you realize that. Okay. I have no issue as well, and with that, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I would move for adoption of a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande amending operating fees for parks and recreation, community development, engineering, building, and fire services, and the addition of a new community development fee.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Any discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes, thanks. That will take us to item 9B, our second public hearing, consideration of request from South County Sanitary Service for integrated solid waste collection rate increase. Steve.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Under the city's franchise agreement with South County Sanitary Service, Inc. for refuse collection and recycling services, they are allowed an annual increase due to inflation, tipping fees, and or regulatory fee changes in interim years. And then every 3 years that they are allowed to request a base rate increase adjustment, at which time they are able to address some other cost factors. This year is an interim year, and they are requesting a rate increase of 3.09% based upon CPI at the time they submitted the request. The city's rate review process is established in accordance with the City of San Luis Obispo rate setting process and methodology manual. Once again, this year, since the manual is developed by the City of San Luis Obispo, we have contracted with Bill Stadler, the City of San Luis Obispo's finance director, to perform our due diligence in reviewing the rate request. And his findings have determined that the rate request is consistent with the terms of the franchise agreement. A copy of his correspondence is included in your report, which provides a summary of those findings. Also attached to your report is a resolution that would approve the proposed increase. Approval is respectfully recommended, and at this time I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. Also, Tom Martin, representing South County Sanitary Service, is here in the audience to be able to answer any specific questions you may have about the application itself.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on the staff report? Okay, this is a public hearing. If there are members of the audience who would like to come forward and comment on item 9B, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. Okay, seeing none, close the public hearing portion of 9B. And Councilmember Guthrie, why don't you start this one for us?
I think this, like the last item, is something that we have to do every year. Is there a set, just one real quick, is there a set number of years where we actually have to go back and do a review of, so every 5 years or something we...
There is a term in the franchise, and I don't believe I have that off the top of my head. Tom may know it, and I think it's different for the recycling and the refuse collection, if I recall. Do you remember what the term... I think off the top of my head, I'm thinking it's about 7 years out or so before we need to go through a renewal process.
I certainly think that the CPI is a reasonable, especially considering the price of gas is just that we're experiencing, that CPI is certainly a reasonable index to use here. So I don't have any trouble with the recommendations as proposed.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens?
Of course to take, and I can support it.
Thank you. I concur with the statements that have already been offered by my colleagues, and with that, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to propose a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande establishing integrated solid waste collection service rates as proposed.
We have a motion and a second. Councilmember Guthrie, second. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor, Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. Item 10 is continued business. We have none this evening. We have two items of new business. Item 11. 11A is consideration of a resolution adopting state affordable housing standards for determination of maximum sales price for affordable housing units. Is that yours, Steve?
Yep. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. As you know, the city has adopted fairly aggressive inclusionary housing requirements to achieve our goal of obtaining more affordable housing units in the city. When those projects are constructed, the units are restricted by requiring an affordable housing agreement and deed restriction. The maximum housing sales price for low, very low, and moderate income units are determined currently by the county-adopted formula. That has resulted in a maximum sales price of approximately $315,000 for the Jasmine Place units. However, based on the county formula, which was just reduced recently, a three-unit affordable, moderate-rate affordable unit now would be a limit at approximately $298,000. That decrease was due to an increase in interest rates. Now, it's important to note that this formula is not universal. For example, the state has its own formula, which the city is actually already required to use on projects within the redevelopment area. In this county, the cities of San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay both have adopted their own formulas, which actually result in a much lower maximum sales price than do either the counties or the states. Since we've had a little experience now with the program, based on that experience and with the assistance of the Housing Trust Fund, staff has evaluated the current formula that we've used, and staff is under the opinion that the county formula is currently too high. And I want to clarify that's a correction in the staff report. I noticed there was a mistake, and that was shown as too low in the staff report. It was too high. And we believe it results in an insufficient range between the minimum income required to qualify for a loan and the maximum amount of income that somebody would be required to have to be eligible to participate as a qualified buyer. This limits the number of individuals and families that could qualify to purchase the affordable housing units, even though they may be in what we believe is our targeted group for this program. One of the key problems with the county's formula is that it is based on an index that is slow to reflect changes in interest rates. Therefore, staff is recommending that instead the city adopt the state's formula for maximum sales price. And the state's formula is based on an assumption that total housing costs should not consume over 30% of gross income for a very low or low income purchased unit, and not over 35% for a moderate income unit. Now, this, as a result of that, it's a little more complicated to administer because it requires the city to make some assumptions on each project about housing costs, interest rates, down payments, those type of things. But we do believe strongly that it results in a much more appropriate maximum sales price at this time, and therefore we are recommending that. An example of a table utilizing that formula is included in your staff report. Based upon how we would propose to implement that formula at this time, it includes an assumption of a 6.125 interest rate and a 10% down payment, and it results in a sales price for a three-bedroom affordable income unit at $271,472, I believe. We recently had a very productive meeting with representatives from the county, the other cities in the county, and the Affordable Housing Trust Fund to try to better coordinate countywide our affordable housing requirements. All the parties at that meeting agreed that this was a question came up just today that we were considering, and that has to do with when the changes in rates apply. And our recommendation, the way we've applied it currently, is how we would continue to recommend that it be applied, and that is when there's a change in the maximum sales price takes place. It would not apply to any units that a seller has reached some type of formal agreement with a buyer on. Prior to that, though, the new sales price, the sellers would be notified, and the new sales price would apply to any units that have not reached any type of written agreement with the buyer or with the buyer between the buyer and the seller at that time. So, in summary, a resolution is attached for your consideration that would approve the state formula for use in our affordable housing agreements, and to set the initial interest rate at 6.125%. And then staff proposes to have a practice of bringing forth recommendations on modifications to the interest rate on a six-month basis. Therefore, we can frequently update that and keep it accurate. And if we have a regular program every 6 months, then those that are involved or impacted by the program will know when we will be considering that and can plan for it, and it won't be a shock to people. So with that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you have. And Jerry Riau from the Housing Trust Fund is here, who helped us quite a bit, and I'm sure he'd be able to help with some of the more technical questions on how the formula actually works, because it is somewhat complicated.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Mayor Pro Tem?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Steve, are we tied to using the 10% down figure? Are we tied to any set formula for taxes, insurance, or do we have flexibility to adjust those every 6 months? How do we set that price?
We have that flexibility. The interest rate in particular would be the main thing that we'd want to change, and that's where we're actually proposing the city council adopt that. The city could adopt the other criteria also, except some of those are going to change project by project basis. For example, there's a category there where we have to determine housing costs, meaning assessment fees or HOA fees. Those we really need to just sit down with the developer and determine what the actual costs are going to be, and then we can plug those in. Down payment, there are some options there. We had looked at 5%, 10%, 15%. That's something we'd like to establish an agreement on and be fairly consistent with that. We felt 10% was somewhat of a middle range, and if you go any lower than that, the housing price drops so dramatically that it almost gets into a point where we were concerned that it was getting too low, frankly. We're trying to find a good balance here. You want the You want the housing cost low enough that the buyers that we're targeting will be able eligible to buy them. You don't want to get the rates so low that it's going to discourage, you know, discourage builders from building the units in the first place. So there would probably be debate on where that balance is, but we feel that this is probably the appropriate median point.
Now, I also notice here that when I look at the attachment one figures, for example, for the 10% down, it shows a cash down payment of 5% with an amount financed with a first loan and a second loan, so that the second mortgage is financing 15%. So is it 5% down or 10% down?
Is that something you could help me with, Jerry? I know on a number of these tables we've actually listed options and recommended a particular option. So we've ran scenarios for the different down payment options, but need to confirm that this particular column relates to that.
The simple answer, or the direct answer, is that the down payment assumption for setting the sales price has nothing to do with individuals' financing of their homes. So the presumption is that the average buyer would make a 10% down payment in this case, and that would set what the maximum price is. Whether the buyer puts 5% down or 25% down is irrelevant to the price calculation. But I also it was pointed out that there was an error in the spreadsheet. That may be a contributing factor to your question.
Well, because 10% down of a 207
is typical, is that they'll put 5% down, and then 80% is financed with a conventional mortgage, and then 15% is financed with a home equity line of credit is typically how they do it. And that provides 95% financing. And it shows what the costs are in comparing those different prices. And then also what the affordability is to different income buyers.
Okay. I understand that. That makes sense. And the question I would ask is that if we anticipate that people are going to be putting down 5%, why aren't we using a 5% down formula instead of a 10% down formula? Because we're basing this on a 10% down price of $271,472.
Right. Like I said, we had looked at different options from the 5 to 10 to 15, I believe.
Even 20.
And even 20. And on an average, that seemed most appropriate and, you know, got us to a level that we felt was the most preferential purchase price. I think we'd have to admit that's fairly subjective on that point. If you'd like, we could go back and do more research in terms of just, I don't know if we can come up with any kind of criteria data on the actual number of these loans and who's paying what in terms of down payments.
If you look at the table, the example, the difference between the 5 and the 10% down payment price is a difference to a developer of around $13,000. But when it comes down to the home buyer, it's a difference of about $80, less than $80 per month. And so there's a concern that if the prices are too low, it makes it more difficult for the developers, and that was just a trade-off. It's a policy question.
Is there any involvement in formulaic here in terms of the amount of income that is going to take to qualify? Does it matter whether it's 5% down or 10% down in terms of the amount of income a person can have to qualify for the home?
Is it a question of the income limits or the... Yeah, the income limits won't change.
They won't change.
What'll change is the minimum income needed to actually qualify for the loan to buy the home. And by dropping it from the county standard to the 10% standard, it makes a difference of... I think you could probably go from... $5,000 a month with perfect credit would be necessary now, that it would drop it probably by 10% or more.
Yeah, I think that would be almost impossible to administer if we were determining the formula on each buyer based on their income.
I was just looking at the, with underwriting perspective, what it takes to qualify for the financing. So with the price dropping that amount, you're looking at $50,000 income qualifying to buy a home versus a $60,000 income.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
I'm done. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Are we going to be using some kind of index to determine the first? Or where, because right now we're talking about setting it at 6.125, but are we, what index are we going to use to determine that? Because if we go to different lenders, the rate could be somewhat subjective. Is there?
Yeah, I think the current rate was based upon an average. So I don't, do you want to answer that? But there is, I mean, that's some, one of the things we talked about. I'm wondering
if
you'd be
more. A couple of websites that are out there. One is HSH.com, and I think that's where the number came from that that I provided Steve. We talked about a couple different numbers, and that particular site verifies the rate with 2,000 lenders every day. And there's also bankrate.com, which does a weekly survey. So there are a number of different places. The government surveys are not as good because they tend to lag, and they also average the adjustable rate interest rates with the fixed rate loans, so that they're not appropriate for this.
Was one of the concerns that I had when I was looking at this was the six-month review, since right in the, for the last several years we've had fairly stable rates, and it does appear that we're going to be seeing a move now. Was there any discussion about looking at maybe tying the review to when Feds raise rates or lower rates, if they go a period of time without raising or lowering? And then I also was confused on the 10%, 5%, but that got clarified. So I believe that was all my questions. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Mr. Mayor. Steve, I had a couple questions. In the staff report, you talk about the fact that this is your proposal currently, but that the under the county formula, that the amount would actually drop to for the moderate income home at 297. What time frame would that happen?
It already occurred.
It already occurred.
I think it was last week.
And what was the influence of that particular drop?
It's the increase in interest rates. As interest rates go up, the affordable housing prices go down. The problem with the county formula is that it uses an index where it's very slow to reflect those interest rate changes. So where we believe the cost the last several months should have reflected that and have raised the price more than we believe they should have been for some of the sales that have taken place over the last few months, the formula is just being adjusted at this time.
So under the current contract, if there's not a home currently under contract that's one of these affordable housing, would the market price now be at 297 as opposed to the 315 that it was previously, automatically?
If they haven't had any agreement, our current practice in implementing this program would apply the new rate to any unit that has not entered into some kind of written agreement with the seller.
Okay. What kind of information do we have in regards to the resale value, county formula versus the formula that you're proposing now? My goal would be to maintain these units in long-term affordability. which means that down the road we're going to want to encourage those that are selling these homes to continue to sell them in the same range. And I know there's the buyouts and the penalties and all those things within this, but as far as these formulas work, which one is going to be, I guess, best, or can we speculate as to how that's going to function from a resale value down the road?
Well, I think the actual formula for resale, I don't believe, would change. And the formula for resale, they have two options. One is the actual affordable housing price at that time, and then the second is taking the original sales price and then determining the increase in cost based upon an index. And Jerry, once again, is going to need to help me with what the definition of that index. But they have two options, whichever is greater of the two.
I think to get to your actual question, the new formula will probably result in more affordable units over time because it takes into account more factors in the cost. But there will be times because the counties, and the county will probably change their index. I've been told that there is a plan to change how they're going to set their prices. But the way that their index works, when interest rates are dropping, they will result in higher prices that are less affordable than the new formula would. And then there are the two formulas, so that the people who buy under the county's formula will still be subject to that formula, and they will have the choice of selling at the higher of the county's formula at the time they sell, or the purchase price plus half of the appreciation of homes within the county. And that's called the house price index. The house price index is calculated by looking at the resale value. The federal government does it. They look at the resale value of the same house over time. So within each county, they have a database that shows how much homes, the same homes, are appreciating over time. And the index would guarantee homeowners at least 50% of that increase, that rate of increase, over time during the however long they own the house. So that provides them with a guarantee of some appreciation. And if the affordability formula results in a higher price, then they can sell at that higher price because it's by definition, it's still affordable.
And then the key thing to add on to that, which is the other part of what you've heard a lot of discussion about, is that is the formula that determines how much equity or appreciation they're able to achieve in the house when they go to sell it. The city does not get any revenue from that. The only time the city is involved is if they sell it at a market rate, which they can't do.
Trouble finding adequate and eligible applicants. Would moving forward with looking at this new formula and decreasing this, would that then increase the ability then to address that particular problem of maybe looking at opening up a wider range of folks that then would be eligible for the affordability?
Yes, I do, and it's only part of a number of things we're looking at. And kind of back up, the whole Jasmine Place project, we were very upfront about identifying this was kind of the first project with a number of units, and it was somewhat of a pilot project for us. It made sense at that time. The logical formula to start out with appeared to be the county because it was all in place and very easy to use. But we've worked very closely with the representatives at SNS and getting feedback, and so we wanted to evaluate the results. So we're working on a number of things involving, and this is the most significant, if we can lower that amount, that's certainly going to increase that range to what we think will be a much more effective range and allow a lot more people to qualify. We're working with them on the next project. They were conditioned in the original project approval to have a workforce housing plan that provided some priorities for different groups, workforce groups, and we're also working with them to have priority given to first-time home buyers, which is something based on the experience with this unit. We want to tie up a little loophole there and really focus more of the efforts on the first-time home buyers. We're working together on, you know, training and how we can assist in marketing the units so they're better understood. There's certainly some confusion out there by potential buyers in terms of how these agreements work, so we're going to be sponsoring some workshops with the help of the Housing Trust Fund to educate both potential buyers and those involved in selling the units. So there's a number of things we have planned, but this is the most significant, and we think this will have a major impact.
Thank you. Some questions.
Okay. Councilmember Guthrie, do you have any?
Yeah, just so I understand the 10% down. If you put 10% down here, doesn't the amount financed is going to go down because the down payment goes up, and therefore wouldn't the price of the home actually have to go up in that case? When the value of the home then be able to go up? So actually the 271 is lower than it actually would be. Just. If you use a 10% down rule.
A 10% down results in a little higher house cost than the 5%. On some of these, we were trying to find a reasonable balance because if we kind of went to the lower extreme in all cases, it resulted in a much lower housing cost, which is already dropping fairly significantly from the original housing cost. So to still keep it within the range that we felt was appropriate and not getting down to a level that we thought it would just end up discouraging housing construction, we tried to, on some of these subjective criteria, we tried to kind of balance between, you know, what the maximum is on this side and maximum on that side, and kind of came with a balanced kind of middle approach on some of those assumptions. But they're certainly open to direction from the council if you're not comfortable with any of those assumptions.
Okay, well, I'll just clarify. I mean, I don't have any trouble with the 10% down. I think that's reasonable. It's just that I wanted to be sure that I understood the spreadsheet, that in fact that would result in a somewhat higher sales price.
And we did run some of these issues by our group when we met with the other jurisdictions in the county, and everybody seemed to agree and were comfortable with that as the assumption also. So that gave us a little bit of security that we were on target in terms of our assumptions.
The second question I had to do with the second, which is here listed at 5%. Is there something that we're tying the second to? It actually would seem to me logically that the second would be more expensive than the first, but it's actually listed here as less. So since the risk is quite a bit higher to the second, was there a website you tied that to as well?
The second mortgage is adjustable, so it's lower at the beginning, that it will go
up.
So
this is an adjustable, and that is permissible?
That would be only for the second.
So the state does permit you to do an adjustable rate?
The state actually doesn't dictate those terms.
And then the 10% isn't something, for instance, in the redevelopment district, the state doesn't use a 10%, they just use the 30% rule, the 30% of income rule.
What the state is concerned about is that the monthly payments for the home buyer, including all of the housing costs, are below a certain dollar amount. And so this formula is a way to back into that dollar amount so that buyers don't pay more than what's considered affordable for the state. So the initial payments on the second mortgage would be at a 5% interest rate. If they got a fixed rate second, it would be higher. So right now I'm not sure if anyone is offering fixed rate seconds.
Okay, so
I've looked at these numbers over the last 20, 30 years. You can't tell which one will go up and which one won't.
In the end, they still have to sell to a qualified buyer.
They have to sell to a qualified buyer.
They could easily end up in a position where they actually have a home that's relatively, that's higher than any qualified buyer. They'd be right back in this spot.
That's possible. But the income limits for the income category are part of the formula, as well as the current interest rates. So those will tend to keep the price within a range that buyers in the same income category can afford. The risk is that we could have runaway inflation, you know, for another 10 years in the housing market. Then we would have problems. But what tends to happen, if you remember the 90s, it goes up and then it tapers off or sometimes even falls before it goes back up again. And that at that balancing point, prices come back into line and then we have spiraling inflation again.
Is that it? Okay. If there are no other questions or clarifications, this is not a public hearing. However, we do allow public input on new business items. If there is any member of the audience that would like to come forward and comment on this item, this would be an opportunity.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, Honorable Councilman. My name is Jack Hardy. I'm here with S&S Homes. I'm also one of the owners of Century 21 Hometown Realty with an office in Arroyo Grande. And there's a lot here that unfortunately is not quite accurate that we'd like to share with you. I think we're trying to fix something that is not broke at Jasmine Place. I also am the listing agent at the Jasmine Place project. There's 17 units there. Every unit is either in contract or in reservation, being approved by either the lender or the Housing Authority, George Moylan at the Housing Authority, who does the actual approval for us that they are an affordable buyer. We already have closed several of the units. We already have people living in those units. 11 of them, I believe, are either closed or will be closing within the next 30 to 45 days. The rest of the balance would be in reservation, just waiting on approval. So we're trying to fix a problem. We don't need more buyers. It is the difficulty that we have been experiencing selling these units have not actually been the price. The bigger difficulty is the 30-year deed restriction. It is somewhat complex, and sometimes the buyers, I mean, we've had early on had some difficulty understanding exactly how it works, but we do understand it. We've explained it. Sometimes the buyers have a difficulty understanding it because, as my good friend Steve Adams explained, that the buyers do get all of the affordable price when they sell it, whether it's sold to an affordable buyer or to a market rate. But what sticks out to them is the 90-10 split with the city over and above that, and for 30 years, because for 30 years when they sign up, basically what they're saying is they're going to stay in a home that's not going to appreciate anywhere near as quickly as the rest of the market. So every year that clicks off, they're falling further and further behind. So that's been part of the difficulty with some of the buyers. But we have buyers buying these units. So the problem has not been the price. It's just the deed restriction. We recognize the deed restriction, and we're okay with the deed restriction. And in fact, our organization has provided as much or more affordable housing in this county than anybody. I mean, we've done a number of affordable units over the years. And in fact, if you'll remember, if some of you recall, we offered to do all 47 units at Jasmine Place as affordable units originally. And so we are totally for doing affordable units. But some of the things that I'd like to point out to you, we've talked a lot about the 5%, 10% down. And the reality is that most of these buyers have a very difficult time even making the 5%, much less the 10% down. Now, what you're saying, I think, that's become a little bit confusing on the second sister talking about, is oftentimes the lenders will, with somebody that has 5% down, will also obtain a 15% second for that buyer. Thus, the first is an 80% first that does not require mortgage insurance. So mortgage insurance can be several hundred dollars a month, so it makes the overall payment less, and that's what that's for. But I can tell you there, and we have a lender here in the audience tonight, but in my experience, and I do a lot of deals, I am not aware of any adjustable rate second mortgages out there. They're all fixed rate mortgages, and they are higher than firsts. That's just the name of the game. That's the way it works. So I've never seen an adjustable rate second. I'm not going to say it doesn't exist in the world, but I've never seen it. And I have a Wells Fargo office right next to mine. I can walk over there every day, what's today's rate? And they can get right on the ticker and figure out what the day's rate, and it goes up and down on a daily basis. So to look at a big lag, we haven't seen it. But the problem that we have, as an example, we have 11 people in contract at $315,000. And so this week, you know, as we get these people approved through the housing authority, the next buyers are going to be at $297,000. These people have already, addressing your resale, their resale has gone away a significant amount. Now drop it down to $271,000, their resale goes even further. And we don't think that's a good thing for those buyers. We don't think it's a good thing for the housing market. And the reality is that these affordable units, based on the incomes, the formulas that we use in this county, if you look at other areas like Bakersfield, where the state also calculates these same numbers, where they're over in the valley, their values are a fraction of what our values are here. And so you're applying some of those same values here, and it just doesn't really work. It's not apples and apples. So we think it's not good, and we believe that it would result in far less units being built, because at Parkside alone, we're based on today's program, we would be selling the affordable units at about $2 million collectively below the market. Going to this new program, and it adds on another between $700,000 and $800,000, and you know, builders are going to look at that, and you can only spread so much out in the rest of the project. We think this issue is a bigger issue than just per single project. It's more of a community or society issue that we need to figure out how we can get a true trust fund that we can help these affordable buyers buy homes. Because, you know, the other question is, we're doing this on new homes, and it's getting increasingly difficult, particularly when you start driving the price down for a builder who comes in and does a pro forma early on to figure out what they can pay for the property, what the cost is of getting it approved, what the cost is of building the product, and to spread it around to the other 30 or so units. They're going to have to subsidize that. And does that really work? So we believe it'll result in less units. The other question that I think we all have to ask ourselves: Do these first-time buyers really want to sign up and stay there 30 years? Because every year they're falling further and further behind in the housing market. And so I think we all have to ask ourselves that question, and it makes it difficult at that lower price. So we think there's a better way to do it, and we would just hope that this program does not go forward, that drops the price this dramatically. And we would love to see and be involved in a meeting with the cities and have people from the housing industry there, because there's a lot of information I think we can provide, whether it be the lenders, the real estate people, to provide to make sure that this is all accurate information that you have to make your decision on.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else?
Mike McConville at 529 East Branch Street, Mayor and City Council. I'll second that. You need to hear from the lenders, the builders, and people of the community before you pass something like this. Jack is exactly right. Unless it's a portfolio loan, I don't know of anyone that's doing an adjustable rate second. And it'd be new to the community, that's for sure. You have fixed rate seconds, and then you have seconds, they're called seconds, but they're actually equity lines. And many, many banks are doing that today. They're based upon the prime plus and dependent on the credit score. But that's what you see in seconds, to actually taking the place of and that is an adjustable rate mortgage because it's tied to the prime. So if a reference is made to an adjustable rate mortgage on a second, that's probably what it is. I work for Mid-State Bank, and we call it a HECL, H-E-C-L. And many call it another product, but that's probably what you see. So I suggest that you talk to some lenders, builders, and the community on something like this to beef up this formula. It seems to be awfully complicated, and I've been in lending for 8 years, real estate for 15 before that, and 20 years of accounting before that, and I can't believe a formula could be that complicated. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Affect the current home buyers that are buying over at Jasmine Place and that have bought at the higher price. I just feel sorry. I don't understand. If we adopt this tonight, does it mean the people that are selling at Jasmine Place have to sell for the lower amount? That's a question for staff.
Was that all your comments?
No. Secondly, I like to actually got a letter here from S&S asking for the continuance formally. I'd like to submit that. Because in staff's report, it kind of addressed that this formula would be applied to Parkview. We have a vesting tentative map, and we don't know what the effects of this would have against that. When we put that project forward, we had certain amount of performance, and we had a lot of other expenses, a lot of other costs. We already had our lending approved based on a certain model. That model was shown before the city council. I had a PowerPoint presentation on how that model was going to work. And now that model is going to change if you adopt this and apply it to Parkside. So we have some concerns there because that project was well in the works. Lenders were on board. And that's certainly an issue for us. I do think it's a good idea. Don't get me wrong. I think when a development goes forward, they need to have this at the beginning and be able to put that in their performance and work that out and provide the affordable with this new proposal. But it shouldn't go on the old projects. You shouldn't implement it on projects that have already been approved. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. Seeing no one, we'll close public comment. Councilmember Guthrie, why don't you start this one for us?
Well, I think we all knew when we started pushing the inclusionary housing that it was going to be a complicated and changing objective. I actually just up front don't think that we're quite ready to go forward. I think there is enough confusion over even the program as it's been put forward here. But I guess what we're looking at is two things. One is that no matter what, even if we use the county formula or we use this new formula, the number for any existing development would be changing. It'd be changing based on the interest rate. So in fact, you're always going to be chasing a moving number. So there's going to be no guarantee about what the final result here would be. I like this idea coming in because I'd really like the idea of tying it to something pretty solid that the state has put forward. The problem I'm having is that I didn't realize in reading the staff report that the state formula really isn't that fixed. That you can use 10%, you can use 5%, you could use 30%, and therefore I guess I'm just not comfortable going forward with it as it's presented without working through a few more of these scenarios and dealing also with what happens, for instance, when we look at a $20,000 or $30,000 devaluation in a single day, which is really what happens even if we use the county number here for an existing affordable homeowner. I suspect that's where this indexing would come in, that in fact they would have their value. The problem is that they wouldn't have a qualified buyer because the qualified buyer now has been disqualified because they couldn't meet the income, therefore to meet the payment or the payment structure. So I guess I wouldn't be comfortable without doing a lot more work than I did coming into this. I thought this was actually a little more straightforward than it was, and now in reviewing it, I do think we do need a little more review of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I agree with Jim and a little bit I disagree with Jim. The reality is, as rates go up, the values of the homes based on the formulas are going to go down. The one thing that I think that we might want to consider would be to set the minimum price at what the home was purchased, so that therefore if a home was purchased at an affordable price, in the case of these at $315, they would have the right to, I guess, sell it back at 315, and that would be qualified as an affordable. I'm not sure technically the difference, whether they sold it at 295 and whatever the new number is, they're not going to have a gain. So therefore, if they sold it at 315, they still wouldn't have a gain. So I'm not really sure there's a penalty in any scenario from that standpoint. But I think we should allow them at least to be able to sell them at the price they paid and not have any kind of penalty in that scenario. I'm definitely in favor of setting some kind of formula that is just, you can look it up and determine what the rate is. And I'm affordable units are lottery. I do not believe that if you buy an affordable unit, you should have hit a home run and therefore be able to capitalize on all the appreciation. We are not doing this so that a few people can make a lot of money by buying discounted homes. We're doing this so that we have affordable homes in our inventory. And so I'm actually, from what I've heard tonight, a little concerned that the 50% of the profit based on the federal formulas, that we may see inadvertently some of our homes being converted over time that we were not anticipating, because it will be profitable for homeowners that are doing it. One of the concerns that I had, and since we've worked on this at planning commission, that I've kind of had a little second thought that we might want to revisit, is the 30-year clock being reset on any transfer, whereas I think that we might want to consider that if it's a transfer within a family, that the clock would not be reset, possibly. I think when we talk about the seconds adjustables, I think we're talking about semantics. I think most the loans that are lines of credit now, I think that's what we're seeing a lot. So, because I know several people that have seconds, or they refer to them as seconds, and they're not as the pure definition. So, however they're getting from 80 to 100 is kind of irrelevant. But in most cases, I think it is probably an adjustable. So there is some concern there. I understand staff's consideration of the 5 and 10% numbers. Obviously, if S&S is concerned about us going to the state standard at 10, I'm sure they would love if we went to 5. So I don't think that really needs to be considered as much. I do think we're starting to get down to an area where we probably won't see homes being built. So I'm not sure if there's going to be consensus tonight. I do think there needs to be some maybe modifications to what we're looking at, whether that could be composed tonight or whether we need a continuance for that purpose. As far as the public input goes, this was noticed, and we didn't get any public input other than one group of people. So I'm going to assume that there wasn't a lot of concern as far as us actually lowering the price of homes so that more people could buy them. So that would be all my comments. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Mr. Mayor. I have a couple of comments, and then I'll share what I think needs to happen here. I'm concerned about the moving target and about the fact that we set a standard as to what the terms would be, and it seems to be the possibility of this being a moving target. I think it's important for us to come up with a formula that we're gonna stick with, that is gonna be a long-term formula that can be something that, whether your city staff or whether you're in the development community or whether you're a buyer, you can go and figure out what is that gonna be. What are we gonna be talking about? What I don't like is in a sense we're artificially changing prices, which is in my opinion, really tampering with the resale values at this point. If indeed we have an individual who just purchased a property for $315 and they went and they had to sell it for some reason, they got a job that, you know, offer, and they've got to get out of it, they just lost $40,000. And that's the way I read it. And I think that that's a problem. And I think that that's something that we need to build confidence and stability within both the folks that are buying these homes in the folks that are actually building these homes and selling them. And I think that there needs to be stability. I don't know whether where that stability is going to come from, and whether we, you know, I would certainly look at in the future approving something that's a little more concrete. I think that it might be important for us to hold off on this until we get more buy-in from more communities throughout the county. You talked about working with those and working with other cities and jurisdictions in regards to maintaining something that's going to be a little more consistent across the board, and maybe that's what we need to wait for. So that's my concern. I'm certainly willing to make those adjustments as long as I'm confident that those adjustments that we make in the future are not going to be adjustments that are going to come down the road every 6 months, because I think that creates some instability. I don't want it to be something that is necessarily going to create some ambiguity out in the community. So I'm a little reluctant at this point being out of the area because they're not in this housing market, or else if they were, why would they be getting into these affordable homes? So I'm not sure. They're already further and further behind because of their income. They can't afford, just like myself, I'm in that same category. I can't afford to buy in this area. So I'm not sure we're seeing, you know, people being fearful of getting further and further behind. This is giving them an opportunity to actually own a home and at least build the equity that's allowed within the formula. So and I think that's a good thing. And eventually those folks hopefully can maybe get out of that and maybe move into the fair market area due to their maturity income levels within their families. So I guess at this point I'm a little reluctant to move forward with staff's recommendation as presented. I'd like to have the certainty that what we do next is going to be what's going to be in place for the long term, so that it creates stability. I don't want to have this come back and say, well, the state formula just doesn't meet our needs either in 6 months from now, and then we have to kind of adjust them again. That, to me, I don't think is appropriate. And I guess at this point I'm not confident that that won't happen. So I think it's appropriate that, one, we maybe do a little more work on the tables that are presented. I think there's still some ambiguity. Two, that there may be some folks out there that may need some time to address their concerns in a little more depth. And I don't see that if indeed the current project that the Jasmine Place project is certainly moving forward, and we have the folks, we're finding those folks, and that's great. And I think that we need to create a stability and a confidence in those buyers that they're doing the right thing, and that we're going to support that. So hopefully that helps with my comments.
Thanks. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I got to admit that I'm a little bit confused myself. What's in front of us is the consideration of a resolution adopting the state affordability housing standards for determining the maximum sales price for affordable housing units. I think that it's good that we're going to come to a formula that allows us to have a target that's going to be able to allow more people to qualify. And we've had mixed reports. We've had reports that there were some great difficulties in finding buyers that could afford to get into these homes. Some of the comments I've heard by my colleagues I can agree with. I think that maybe we do need to have some sort of protection so that a buyer that buys one of these homes that turns around and needs to sell it isn't going to take a loss. But then I have a question. Steve, could you maybe clarify for me, what was the point to a buyer can maintain 50% of the appreciation of the house if they sell the house for market value? Or what exactly are we talking about with that?
Let me see if I know what you're getting at. Once again, the formula is for a buyer when they go to sell. There's two criteria. They can sell at the rate at that time for the affordable house. So if there's been appreciation in that, they can get that appreciation. The other formula, which is the one I always need help describing, it's an index that is based upon how much an index has gone up over their current price. Why don't you? I think that's probably the option that you were talking about. And what's important to note is they get the greater of the two. So with these two options, there's some guarantee that rarely does somebody lose money on one of these projects.
Okay. The second index is that people can sell their home for what they paid for the house plus 50% of the increase in the house price index, which is an index that measures the average increase of the same home in the market over time. So if a person buys the home at Jasmine for $315, they will be able to sell it for $315 plus 50% of the average increase in the resale value of the same home over time. Or the
of that home or of the comparable homes in the development?
What happens is the federal government looks at home sales over time. And if they find that my home, 208 Trevino, sold in 1976, in 1985, in 1999, in 2003.
Thank you. Appreciate that. You had something to add, Steve?
Well, I don't want to interrupt your comments. I just thought of a couple options that we might want to throw out for your consideration. I don't know if this is the appropriate time.
Maybe we finish our comments.
Yeah, I think I'll be happy to hear myself a little bit later. Go back to what are we trying to do here? We're trying to put homes into our index that are affordable, that people can get into. We're not trying to provide a platform where people can build a lot of equity and move up. We're trying to put affordable homes into our inventory. If there is a mechanism whereby someone who buys that house has the opportunity to sell it at a future time and make somewhat of a profit, maybe not necessarily what the profit is going to be for market value, I think that's good, as long as there is a way to keep that home somehow or other also in the affordability range, and so that some of the profit from that house is going to go back into feeding the affordable market and helping other people get into the affordable houses. So I think I'm bottom line is I'm willing to wait and see a little bit more about this matter and maybe reconsider it at a later time. But I do approve and I do support our adopting a resolution that will set a more reasonable, affordable level for our homes and will allow people to get into them.
Thanks. Well, I want to make a couple of comments about I think what's being proposed tonight, and I would have to support many of the observations that have already been made, both by the council and by members of the public. First of all, my original take on the tables that were submitted, and I'm not sure where they originated from, but attachment one, at least in my estimation, I think attempts to do too much on one sheet. I think if we were to break this down in lay terms, I mean, if we can't understand it, if the public that's here tonight is having some difficulty understanding it, how are we going to sell this policy throughout the city? So I think that perhaps we need to revisit the way in which, when we decide what that policy is going to be, the way in which we present it, the way in which it's organized. I applaud what we're attempting to do here in spirit. I have some difficulty at this point aligning anything that we do in the way of affordable housing, formula-wise or in any other way, with something that the state puts forth. The public notwithstanding, the comments notwithstanding this evening, I do believe there's enough here for us to explore the notion that what we're being handed here is a one-size-fits-all. I believe there's some uniqueness to the county, and particularly the Central Coast, that we may need to take another look at. The Mayor Pro Tem made a comment that I was going to make, and that is that, from the very beginning, we're not kidding ourselves here. There's no way in this in this market environment that anyone who wants to buy a home is going to be able to buy a home. That, at least in my mind, was never the intent. We can't fix that all by ourselves. But what we can do is work towards a policy that supports workforce housing, and I would just as soon substitute that term for affordable housing. At least my goal going into this whole housing issue was to keep the scenario that we see happening over and over again, where a city or a county or any government agency will make a job offer to someone who immediately looks at the salary that he or she is going to get, looks at the market price of homes, and says, I'm sorry, I'd love to come there, but I can't afford it. It doesn't have to be a government agency. It could be a hospital. It could be the school district, whatever the case may be. So, that has always been sort of the goal for me, was to come up with some sort of a policy that would allow us to continue to support our workforce here in the city. I'm a little bit, taken back, Steve, with, even with looking at this in midstream, it kind of throws those expectations askew. I'd like us to take a more in-depth look at this. I'd like us to do more research in terms of the financing, particularly some of the formulas that are being proposed here. And I would also, and I understand that this was on as a new business item, but I think this is significant enough so that when it does come back to us, that it comes back as a public hearing, and we notice it as such. Because if we don't, I think we're going to wind up hearing from the community. So I would like to have this come back. Again, I applaud what it is that we're trying to do in spirit, but I think we got a little more work to do. So those are my comments.
Mr. Mayor, if I may, I would like to at least request staff, if regardless of what the motion is, whether it's going to be continued or whether it's brought back at another time or however we decide that, I like the spreadsheets that have been put out here. I think that as you mentioned, that they are probably trying to take on a little too much with what they're presenting. But if we could put something together with some different scenarios, and I would personally like to see, based on maybe several different assumptions, what a resale would look like in 5-10 years down the road. And I know there has to be some assumptions made, and maybe different types of assumptions. To me, that would be important. I'm a little confused, a little fuzzy in regards to, the higher of these two formulas. And if I could see it on paper and see what that might look like, given certain parameters, that would be really helpful for me. Thank you.
I also wanted to just kick something else in here. I think if we're going to continue to sell this, we have to take into consideration not only the material benefits, which in this case probably aren't huge, but there are also, particularly for a first-time home buyer, member of the workforce, there are some intrinsic benefits that we're not really emphasizing here. They get to live here, number one. They are going to have some degree of appreciation, certainly not as much, but they get established with perhaps a better line of credit or a better credit report or whatever the case may be. They get started. So that, you know, there are some ancillary intrinsic benefits to taking part in this program. So maybe, you know, some of those things can be emphasized as well. Any other comments?
Just one quick additional comment. I just hope that the plan going forward, where you were going to go and do some educational things out there, I hope that that'll go forward independent of this, because I think that really is one of the real keys, is developing a pool of qualified buyers so that when the units come up, there's not just you're not out chasing them down today, that there's a pool of them available, but also when they come up for resale and sometime in the future there will, that there's always a pool. The normal real estate industry isn't going to keep these people around. It's going to take some sort of a nonprofit type activity in order to keep this pool of buyers around. And I think that's really one of the keys going forward is going to be the real estate side of this, let alone the development side, but the real estate side going forward. Otherwise, these are all going to fall out. They're all going to end up at market rate, and whatever the deal with the city is going to be the deal, because it's going to be too difficult to sell them when it comes time to do it.
Yeah, and that was the educational program that was really designed to deal with some of the points the mayor just made in terms of those intrinsic things. The maximum sales price really wasn't geared towards that. Those issues really fall under the marketing program, but we do agree that that's a key component of the overall program in our efforts.
You know, that was another comment that I was going to make was, you know, our buy-in as a city. And, you know, Rob's far enough back there so he can't throw anything at me. But, you know, I think if this is going to be a partnership, then, you know, we have to have something on our webpage that maybe refers to what Jim was saying a second ago. You know, if we're going to have something that says job opportunities, we've got to have something that says housing opportunities or, you know, housing on the Central Coast or something like that. And maybe it's just a link to some of the projects that we have ongoing that turns them on or points them into a direction where they can pursue those things. So if it's going to be a partnership, then, you know, we got to buy in. And
I can agree that we're playing some fuzzy math with how much is being used as a second versus how much is a first, and especially if it's an adjustable. But that's somewhat of a risk that the buyer is going to understand, and they're going to be willing to take that. My concern is that if we are starting to look at, we're not going to allow the prices to go below a certain level, that really what we're going to be doing then is we're going to be creating less affordable houses as interest rates are going to go up. I don't think anybody here truly anticipates that everybody's concerned now that we're at 6% and they've gone up so much, and these are still historically low numbers. So the likelihood that we're going to see numbers get to 7 maybe by the end of the year, which by definition are going to drive these homes down in price. And so I just want to make that kind of, you know, my point, that I think that stability isn't going to exist if we're truly talking about the affordableness of the homes.
I think what you're hearing, Ed, is that there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of uncertainty. And your point is well taken, but, you know, I don't see enough here to convince me one way or the other. And so I guess what we're all asking for are answers and scenarios, as was pointed out, that can demonstrate, you know, perhaps what you're saying. So I don't think we're ready to move in any direction right now without additional information. So.
And I don't have that problem. I just, when you talk about assurities, my concern was is that we were talking about just that we're not going to have the high prices of home, and based on what we've heard, that there is no penalty for selling at what you paid, basically, because you're guaranteed that plus 50% of the whatever this index will indicate. So therefore, you could sell back an affordable unit back into the housing market at the affordable price that you paid, by definition. And so therefore those people are not losing money. They're not being forced to sell at the new affordable price. The whole purpose of the new affordable price is because the new buyers are going to be getting a higher interest rate,
And so therefore, by definition, that's going to make the home less affordable. I guess that was my point that I was going to...
But I think one of the points is, though, is that if the affordable price of the home has gone down and you sell it at its old affordable price, nobody's going to qualify. The qualified, if there's a $40,000, they're going to need to come up with $40,000 more down payment in order to qualify to buy the $315,000 home.
But the point is that the person has that right to sell, so
he can't because there's nobody qualified. So it's going to end up at market rate.
That may be something that we have to understand, but I think that at that point they could sell to someone that can afford to buy that house. I'm not real clear on, but I guess by definition you could sell the house what you paid for and not be penalized.
Let me focus on a comment that you just made.
Not real clear.
I think that's what we're hearing from all of us here. There's more information that needs to be forthcoming. So I would recommend that the two of you have coffee and then maybe go see Steve. Okay.
Mr. Mayor, I was wondering if I could have just one opportunity to maybe throw out some options before you get to making any recommendations. To me, from what I'm hearing, it's clear that I think unanimously folks are going to need some additional information in terms of these technical items, and we apologize for the technicality of this whole thing, but it's something we've been struggling with also. It's a very technical and new area to all of us. I heard kind of three different, while some consistency, kind of three little different approaches in terms of what the concerns were. Some folks' concerns seemed to focus not so much with the county formula itself in terms of, actually with some of the description, I kind of sensed that overall in terms of the concepts of the county formula maybe would work, but there was a lot of concerns with how the criteria in which we determine the actual housing price under that formula set by the state formula, how that would work and how can we tighten that up so there's some standardization and some predictability with, and how can we explain those and maybe simplify those. So one option, if there was comfort level with that state formula, but discomfort with this whole process of how does the city take that and compute the actual housing number, one option would be to go ahead and improve the state formula, but have staff come back and provide more data and recommendations and criteria of how we would implement that. That's one option. The second option, as I heard others, were also maybe somewhat comfortable with the structure, but had concerns with the individual criteria, but they also had concerns how that relates to the state formula, and so there's probably discomfort with the whole, had it all worked out, it was simple, we just took it and we could use it, but over time we're not thinking that's appropriate formula. And then there was some discussion about whether we wanted something to more, you know, specifically deal with our needs in Aurora Grandy and customize it more. And that was an option we started. That is an option. It was an option we started off with. In fact, Jerry had drafted something similar to the state, but much simplified and easy to use for us. Our concern with that was just one of our goals is to standardize with the city, standardize within the county. One of the problems we've had is working with lenders and trying to educate lenders and coming up with something countywide that they can get used to dealing with and that we feel would just make the whole system work. So that's certainly a direction. It's a valid direction. It's a direction we'll take and come back with if that's your preference. I just want to let you know our goals have been kind of going in an opposite direction and seeing how we can standardize throughout the county, and the state formula seemed to provide something that we could all use, and it also becomes a little easier to justify when we go out to meet with builders and building community if we're working with something that is somewhat standardized out there and is not just something we developed on our own and try to justify it that way. So that was just my kind of perspective on those kind of maybe the different approaches and concerns, and anything I can do to get maybe some consensus on the direction you want me to go at this point based on that.
Well, I personally would like to see what you started to do on your own. I liked how you described it, Steve. You said it was it fit us perhaps better than it would fit somewhere else, and it was simple, or more simple than what we have right now in terms of whether or not we're likely to to get consensus or support from lenders. I think if during the development of this formula, whatever it might be, if it's something unique to us, if we bounce it off of the development community, if we bounce it off the financial community, particularly here in Arroyo Grande, we got Midstate, who's a player, some of the other banks. So, I think we can get their feedback and tell whether or not we're going to hit the target or not. So I would not like to toss that out as an option. I'd like to see what you started to do and compare that to what you might bring back as a more clarified version of the state formula. Are there any other kind of hoped for outcomes here in terms of direction for Steve, other than what he said?
Well, I do think on the scenarios end, it's looking at several like 5-year scenarios and look at what happens with it, if interest rates do this, if interest rates do that. Looking at those possible scenarios, particularly on resales going down the road. I do think one of the things that Ed and I are agreeing on is that no matter what, if interest rates go up, the price of the homes goes down, or you just have fewer people qualified. So I would like to see, use some sort of a range like 5 years to do something more reasonable than 1 month, but some sort of a scenario that would give us some ideas there, and also look at what happens then if we use some historical 10-year indexing rate, how that indexing really works. I think if you used the last 10 years, that all of the homes would be sold on the 50% index, and none of them would be sold at the income affordability rates. And also, then where do we actually end up if in fact they have to be sold at market rate? And what happens with the equity that's there? How does that actually work? We're hearing very very distant discussions about how that equity sharing would take place. 90-10 seems a little extreme to me, but those are the kind of scenarios that I'd like to see worked out. I'm a little embarrassed that frankly I didn't do a little more work in advance, or I would have actually worked some of them out, because now that I look at it, it's obvious that it's not here. I think so.
Does that give you enough for now?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a motion?
I'd make a motion that we can continue this item to a date uncertain.
Will you amend it to a public hearing?
Is that sufficient?
Yeah, I was just. I also heard interested in listing this as a public hearing, agendizing it as a public hearing. That gives the ability to do that.
Yeah, would you be okay with that?
That's fine.
Second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Not roll call.
Installation and conversion. Based upon estimates and assumptions, after about a year of negotiation with PG&E, this fixture, which is currently installed on the Trafficway Bridge, independent of the Let There Be Light program, that was a part of the Bridge Rail project, the lights that will be installed are along the creek promenade. They are not yet in place. Six around the gazebo were existing. Six new fixtures were to be installed as a part of the promenade. Were financed by $1,500 donations for existing pole and $2,000 donations for new poles. That was understood to be the hardware cost, and it was presumed that we could utilize the existing circuitry and the existing poles with PG&E. What actually evolved in the contract with the Creek Promenade
is PG&E changed the assumption that they could use existing circuitry, and it had to be one of two things, either a private metered system or a disconnect at the base of each pole. We had to go into a design contract with the Creek Promenade to establish the new metered system along the promenade, and then we tried to design around the gazebo, but PG&E couldn't provide as-builts. We did some additional design work. There was an item on your consent agenda that caused some cost increase, but the city spent almost as much as was donated for the hardware to complete phase one, which means that the actual cost per pole was closer to $3,000 to $4,000, and that was prior to getting into more expensive street lighting on an existing sidewalk, which is partially city-owned and partially state-owned. So we could envision that continuing this particular program would cost us approximately $4,500 a pole. That's cheaper than most of the other jurisdictions that are doing pedestrian lighting. San Luis Obispo, Pismo Beach, Grover Beach are spending more per pole than that. However, and that's the bad news, that we spent more than what the donation program effectively was designed to cover. The good news is, in this year period, PG&E has developed a potential new program in cooperation with a lighting company that was one of the original contenders, Holothane, an extremely qualified quality firm. They have a glass fixture rather than a acrylic fixture. They sell accessories, including banner arms, what I call cages, but it's ribs, bands, medallions, finials that can fit on or around the light to customize it. But Holothane and PG&E will allow this fixture to be installed as a PG&E fixture. The city would have no maintenance obligation. It would essentially be like our current lanterns along the street, but instead of having to choose the lantern and the old pole, we have a preliminary estimate, and I'm cautious because we have had preliminary estimates before, of $2,500 per pole from PG&E to make this standard holothane Granville glass acorn fixture and a either straight or fluted aluminum extruded pole with a decorative cast base. This is without any customizing, but also without any disconnect because it would be a PG&E system. So we could avoid a lot of disruption of sidewalks or trenching to install conduits to separate from PG&E. Allowing $500 additional per pole to finalize it and to customize it, this appears to be a preferred alternative than going ahead with a $4,000 to $4,500 per pole private system, which could still escalate in cost because of all of the design difficulties and disconnect potentials. So staff is returning to the City Council with the completion and expectation that we will, along the Creek Promenade, utilize the Phase 1 fixture. I'll deal with the change of recommendation from the Lumic fixture along the Creek Promenade to the holothane fixtures and poles along the branch and side streets within the village. There's approximately 40 lights total existing along the streets. And then I would like to give you some additional news if that is an acceptable design standard. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and respond.
Did you take this back to the Village Improvement Association, Rob?
I have, and the Village Improvement Association thinks that this is the appropriate adjustment.
And did the Historical Society take a look at it?
The Historical Society was not originally a party to and has not yet converted the lights along the Heritage Square. There's four existing lights along their segment of lease land on the Village Green, and I will approach them with the old system and the old hardware. That would be an extension of the promenade, so we wouldn't attempt to use the PG&E fixture on our city system.
Do you have a picture of some of the trim and what did you call them?
Ribs, cages, finials, yes.
Something that that would enhance that big glass fixture there so that it looks something like what we had?
This catalog obviously is a little bit more difficult to deal with.
There are specifications, and you can buy, as an example, the lower right hand of the four takes the typical acorn, Granville acorn, and with the projection on the top is called a finial. You can buy a cap. You can buy the ribs, which are the vertical members. You can buy a band that goes around the light separately. So you can customize the acorn to be very similar in detail to the fixture that we selected. In fact, one of the fixtures that we had originally sampled was this fixture that's on the lower right-hand corner. That is a slightly different shape, so it's not going to look identical to the lights that are on the trafficway bridge. If you are reluctant to make this decision without having a sample, I'm arranging with the a Holothane company to provide us a formal sample of that fixture, the pole and the light, so I could place it. That should be available by the end of April. I'm also arranging and requesting from PG&E confirmation of the preliminary. Until we decide what is our hardware, and even when we've made that choice, if we decide we want to have a private system rather than PG&E, I can get more specific about the cost consequences. But be aware that when we work in the sidewalk areas, and because a PG&E system interlinks between light fixtures and private services, that PG&E finally stipulated that any city system, a city-owned pole and light, would have to have a disconnect. And the disconnect can cost almost as much as the pole and light, or more. So I'm still concerned about the potential success of getting 4,500 or higher donation per pole with our current Let There Be Light program.
Any other questions for Rob?
Yeah. Rob, I just in regards to the addition of the trim, the cages, and so forth that are the possibilities, at that point, does PG&E still maintain? I mean, that can still be maintained by PG&E even with those accessories?
PG&E is saying if you customize the cage, the city may have to stock the cage because they don't want to get into the fixture business. Holothane, and it's a relatively minor cost. PG&E has consented to banner arm installation, but they also don't want that accessory at their expense. So they're willing to allow the city to customize the poles, and there may be some elements of city ownership on the...
Okay. All right.
Uh, I can bring in our globe. They're very similar in actual diameter and height.
It's just taller,
right?
Is why it looks.
It's primarily the glass versus plastic in terms of holothane versus lumic, and the shape of the acorn.
Any other questions,
Mr. Mayor, if I may, Rob? The poles and lights that have been placed on the traffic wave bridge are the exact replica of what we see up here to the right.
They are the lumic fixture that is on the right side. Correct. That is the and in that instance, it is the smooth aluminum pole. There is no decorative base because it's on the pedestal of the bridge. In the case of the promenade, which will it's promised to start installation tomorrow, we should be able to complete that about the same time the sample fixture would come in from Holothane. We will have the actual promenade in place, and you could look at both if you're reluctant to act tonight. The cost consequences, I think, are predictably causing the shift, not the design difference.
It's interesting to me that they seem larger, of course, when you're closer up, but the ones as I drove by, it didn't look like they were the same ones because they, at that height, didn't
right.
have the same feel to it. But
right.
They look nice.
I can bring the fixture, which is in the conference room, out, and it looks huge until you put it on a 12-foot pole, and then it looks in proportion.
Very reasonable. Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, I'd like to invite members of the public to come forward. If there are any comments on 11B, this would be an opportunity. Okay, seeing none, close that. Let's see. Councilmember Arnold, why don't you start us here?
Obviously, there's going to be a slight difference, but I don't think it would be to the level of concern that we're really changing the feel of what was we were trying to accomplish, and considering the considerable cost distance or cost difference between the two systems, I would be in favor of making the switch. The fact that the new lights also will have the glass lantern versus the plastic would seem that over time they may actually be a more desirable product. So I would definitely encourage that wherever we have the private system that we're, I guess, the city system, that we continue to stay with the similar ones, which is what you're proposing. But definitely along Branch Street, I think it would be appropriate to switch to the PG&E system. So I can support that. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Rob, I don't have a problem. I think that the concept is that we're moving forward to enhance the village look, and I think that both of these accomplish that. I think I'd certainly I don't think we're going to see a major difference, especially once we get the cages and the trim placed. I think it would be important to try to mimic that as close as possible, but for the most part, I think it's more of a it just causes a more visually pleasing and aesthetic approach to the village, and I think that that's fine. And I think it's unfortunate that we've come into all these roadblocks with what we're trying to do, but I appreciate all the hard work you're putting into it and think this is a real reasonable compromise.
Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie?
Yeah, I too have no problem with the new design. I mean, clearly the short-run capital costs and the long-run maintenance costs really make this a pretty easy decision.
Mayor Pro Tem?
I have to agree. I think that in terms of the increased costs and the relative similarity between the two, let's go with the proposal as you're making it tonight.
Thank you. I'm not a lighting expert, but I'm amazed at the difference in cost and maintenance and wiring and all of the rest of that between the two models. It's hard for me to understand how they justify that. Mm-hmm. But the fact remains that is their position, and so we're left with, I think, the alternative that you presented tonight, Rob, and I too have no issue with it. I think given the options that we have available through the manufacturer to dress this up, I would have no problem moving forward with your recommendation. with the caveat that that we would look at their accessory list and try and make them look like we had originally planned. So a little bit more of a cost, but I think well worth it. With that, I'll entertain a motion.
I'll do the conversion in the remainder of 2005 if PG&E will stick to this concept, and thanks to the Mankins family for the quantum leap forward with Phase 2.
Very good. Okay, that is indeed good news, and certainly recognition is in order, and I'll leave it to you to arrange a fitting time and place, and we'll do our part.
Mr. Mayor, while you're on recognition, can I interrupt you just for a sec? Because I would like to provide some recognition to Rob Strong for this project. So this is a project from way back when we were developing the streetscape project for the village that we worked together on. And this was one of the components of many that got stalled because there wasn't any funding available. And Rob really took that as that he was not going to take that as discouragement of having this not go forward. So he was determined to figure out another way to make this project go forward. So pretty much developed on his own this concept and went out and solicited contributions and got the survey going citywide, and really the whole success of this thing, even though it's at some points is pushed ahead even faster than makes me comfortable. But overall, like I said, we have to really attribute most of the success to Rob. It's really been his baby all along, so I'd like to recognize that.
Okay, so what sort of incentives do you have in mind for Rob? Oh, okay.
Yeah, we'll hold off any more recognition until the project's done.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Mayor, I move that the City Council approve the revisions for the fixture poles and lighting system design and donations for remaining street lighting within the village area to the newly proposed PG&E alternative.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay, a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thanks, Rob. We're making light of it, but we do appreciate all of the hard work you. I think we're finally going to see them out there. It's going to be very nice. Okay, that takes us to item 12, City Council Member Items. I have one that I would like to introduce to the council tonight. It's a request to forward comments to the County Board of Supervisors on Cypress Ridge Phase 2 project. And Rob and I had a discussion about this. And Rob, if you could just provide a quick summary of what's happening with the Board of Supervisors and some of the concerns of the city.
On August 30th, the Planning and Building Department gave us a project referral within our planning area for a proposed general plan amendment involving Cypress Ridge area. It would accommodate a 295-home additional project and a 9-hole golf course, as well as an adjustment of the Palo Mesa Village Reserve or Village Limit area. And the consequence would be to convert 147 acres, 90 acres of which were planted in strawberries, from current rural residential designation, which allows one unit per 5 acres, to single-family residential, which would enable the 295 homes. We were given 15 days to respond. I commented that neither the Planning Commission nor the City Council would have an opportunity to comment, but I was confident that the staff's response was at least a tip of the iceberg warning. And my response was that the plan amendment would raise major issues related to not only land use, but water, air quality, and traffic, and commented that Cypress Ridge is already almost a new town without adequate urban services, water resources, or coordinated planning. So I basically stated that the city would insist on an EIR if the county considers and authorizes the project, and I hoped it would go away. There is no current consideration of alternatives. There are a lot of general plan amendment possibilities other than the quantum leap from rural residential to single-family residential. The most obvious would be to look at the residential suburban designation, which is what makes up most of the current Cypress Ridge. That would allow one unit per acre potential, which would yield 147 units instead of 295. But there's still water, traffic, etc. As an example, I'm sure you're familiar with the Busick track, which is 16 units at the El Campo interchange adjoining the city limits where Orchard Street terminates Castillo Del Mar and Vista Del Mar adjoin Falcon Ridge. That 16 units has taken 5 years or more to develop an EIR, which is also being distributed by the county, dealing with significant adverse effects of traffic, water, etc. And it's almost minuscule in comparison with Cypress Ridge. We can go and try to dissuade the board from authorizing consideration because it will take time and a lot of money to do an environmental evaluation. I think without El Campo Interchange and Halsey and Briscoe Interchange and all the impacts that are currently under consideration in the Mesa with water and traffic, that this is premature at best, but it's still a county board decision of whether or not to allow the applicant to throw his money at this proposal. I'm here to ask your direction. Again, it wasn't agendized. There will not be another city council meeting before this board hearing, so it almost means that we can just reinforce staff statement saying, again, we weren't given enough notice to form a formal opinion in a public hearing. But I do feel like it is a critical moment for that this Cypress Ridge portion of Napomo Mesa.
Tim, I have a question. How much latitude do we have, given the circumstances, for some sort of consensus direction, not a motion, but some sort of consensus to perhaps give Rob some authority to at least state the comments that he shared with us tonight, which I think in one form or another we've heard on previous occasions?
I think this is very a very unusual agenda item. It is agendized in a format where I think you have latitude to pretty much chime in as you wish.
Okay. Thanks. Comments?
Question and then a comment, if I may. Rob, could you just identify the you have the project site out there, but my eyes aren't good enough to see. What road is that on, and where is that in location to the current Cypress Ridge?
It is east of the bulk of the existing Cypress Ridge golf course and homes. It is on Halcyon, at the end of Halcyon Road, where it tees into a street called Zenon, Z-E-N-O-N Way. The access would then be logically from Zenon to Halcyon to either El Campo or continuing down Halcyon to Valley, any road you take other than traveling all the way down Highway 1 through Oceano and Pismo Beach will traverse the deficient El Campo, Briscoe, Halcyon interchanges. It will. All of these trips will impact the city.
Rob, is El Campo depicted on this particular map right now?
Yes, right at this.
This is the rest of Cypress Ridge. Basically, from this point over to El Campo is Cypress Ridge.
This is El Campo here?
Correct. So El Campo Road is one of the primary entrances into Cypress Ridge.
Okay.
This goes on to the intersection with Highway 101. This goes on to Valley Road.
Right. So this is Halcyon right here then?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, let me sort of summarize what I was hoping for here. What I was hoping for was that given the time constraints, that the council, by way of consensus, would allow Rob to perhaps carry a letter summarizing the concerns as you've described this evening, whether it's signed by me on behalf of the council. Track is extremely valuable in that discussion as well, Rob, because it's a very... It's a very strong position, I think, that supports the Mayor Pro Tem's comment. Any other comments?
I can also support that without any problem.
I guess I just want one clarification. Their action, though, it sounded to me like they are actually looking to request starting the process of doing an environmental report. That's actually the direction they're going.
If the board authorizes consideration of the general plan amendment, I'm confident that if the applicant isn't volunteering it, the county would at least require a comprehensive EIR. I think it's an extremely complicated EIR because we don't have any programmed mitigation for El Campo, Halcyon, Briscoe. We don't even have the county collecting any fees for improvement of El Campo Road, let alone impacts on the city's road system. So, and that's one issue. There's water, there's air quality, and there's agricultural conversion issues, which I would hope that the county board would take the initial step and say it's premature and it may be totally inappropriate, period. If they don't do that, then they could say this is going to be a very exhaustive and speculative venture on the part of Cypress Ridge 2 with a probable outcome of major contributions or requirements that they do what the city has done, which is said El Campo has to be in place before the project can proceed, or both Halcyon and El Campo have to be in place before the project can proceed, and you should produce the water up front or don't even bother to come back because they're proposing to use the water that they irrigated the strawberries for 1 year as the no net increase in water pumping, but there's no information to sustain the water resource.
I guess that was where my comment was going, is I'd actually be looking for stronger language than simply an EIR would be required, that in reality, given the all of the loose environmental ends that exist in on the Napomo Mesa right now, there really would be inappropriate to go forward with any plan at this point until they've got all the other issues resolved.
I can certainly, with council's consent and direction, prepare a letter that would encourage the county not to authorize, as the city's recommendation. Secondly, to recommend, if they do authorize, a lesser land use intensity. And thirdly, if they authorize it under any form, to require a comprehensive EIR and evidence of mitigation before the project returns.
Sounds good.
Okay, I think we have some consensus. Did you have something, Steve?
Oh, just traditionally, I've been granted authority to prepare letters either for my signature or your signature on items that we feel a fairly high confidence level is going to be detrimental to the city or something that's been endorsed by the League of California Cities. So I think I'm pretty confident, based on the feedback we got, that I could go back and work with Rob and prepare that for your signature, if that's your preference.
And we'll have representation there to present that letter. I'd like to get on record at their meeting. So, okay. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, I had another item. Yep. For informational purposes, I would comment that the Busick Tract, I am requesting 5 CDs. I have a single hard copy received from the county late last week. I requested the 5 CDs but have not yet received them. We have until May 23rd for comments on the recirculating draft EIR. This is not the final, but it does reflect feasibility issues because of the alternative being rejected by the city. So it's back to El Campo Road as a solution.
Oh, before I forget, Rob, on the letter that we just spoke of, we might introduce the whole issue of the traffic model as well, the county's traffic model. And Councilmember Dickens, you had an item as well?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Under Councilmember items, I'd like to also ask staff to investigate a concern that was brought to me by a couple of colleagues at Arroyo Grande High School. Apparently, there is also another proposed subdivision that's referred to as the 19-acre Godfrey Tract map out of Corbett Canyon, which is approximately 1 mile north of Arroyo Grande. This particular subdivision is planned to go before the Planning Commission this Thursday, April 14th. That's all I know about it, and I told that these constituents that I would at least ask for further information to see what the specific proposal was, and if we can get some feedback as to whether that may be impact on the city of Arroyo Grande and whether we would like to take a position on that particular subdivision proposal as well.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Mayor, I had one item also. This may fall under the communications more, the comments. The plumbing retro program right now, I have a friend that's actually in the process of remodeling his flooring and things like that, and to put his helmet for sale, and I suggested that he had the high-flow toilets that he might want to...
Overall, it seems to be at a fairly low volume of...
Thank you.
All right. We had a fair amount of action on item 12 there. Item 13, city manager items. Anything other than what we've already explored, Steve?
No, sir.
Okay. Item 14, any council communication? Staff communication?
Just to make an announcement that everybody, I think, is already aware of, on April 29th is our next League of California Cities Channel Counties meeting, and I would like to encourage whoever can make that to attend meetings in Ojai.
Okay. And that takes us to item 16, community comments and suggestions, opportunity for any member of the audience to come forward and make any comments on any item. No one? Okay, that takes us to item 17, adjournment.
So moved.
Good. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you.